Hi, everybody. Steve Savitsky here with Savitsky Talks. And today, I am really honored, really, really honored to have Malcolm Holmline, the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major Jewish Organizations, a great friend of the Orthodox Union, a personal friend, a person who I admire, respect. I can go on and on, but that's not the purpose of what we hear. Malcolm, how are you today?
Good, thank God. And it's always a pleasure to be with you. And I could have said that and more about you and your involvement and leadership, which we really appreciate.
Well, thank you so much. And we, of course, the Orthodox Union, are proud, proud members of the conference and appreciate everything you do for the Jewish people. So in the next edition of the Jewish Action, which is really widely read and Baruch Hashem, a tremendous, tremendous periodical, the future and the cover actually talks about, the cover story is, do Jews have a future in Europe? Now, I know you actually came to the OU convention just a few weeks ago, and you were one of the keynote speakers, and you spoke about this, and feel very unfortunately that there may not be a future for European Jewry. So the question really is, my first question is, so where did they go wrong? What happened?
That's actually a very good question that very few people ask. And what I said at the OU convention, I spoke very directly, and I said that people, you can't obfuscate on this issue because lives are at stake. And what I talked about, the dangers to the French community, and there were others who took different positions, and unfortunately vindicated a few days later by not only the attacks, but by people beginning to examine and the facts coming out. And the statistics I gave there now have been superseded by the ones put out by the French community itself, which talks about this massive increase, the number of anti-Semitic attacks, the violent attacks that Jews are the victims, I think, of 50 to 60% of the attacks. They're 1% of the population. So it's not just France, Belgium, Holland, every country in Europe today, including England, faces this problem. And the question that you ask, it's appropriate. How did we get to a point where Jews, young Jews, talk universally about leaving? I spoke this morning to leaders in two countries, and they tell us that the young people are leaving, and they're planning to leave. 25% of the graduates of French colleges say they're going to leave immediately after graduation. 250,000 French people, not Jews, left last year from France, and certainly the Jewish Aliyah is increasing. But it's not just there, in Holland, in other countries. And the result is that the demographic imbalance increases because when young people, those who are will be of childbearing age and raising families age, leave, you increase the imbalance, which today has the Muslims growing at over 4%, 4.1, 4.2, and Europeans between 1.4 and 1.7 or 8. And the 75% of the Muslims are under 25, whereas the European population is aging rapidly. You have, so many statistics. If you look at the birth rates, 40% of the births in Germany are French, are Muslim children. In France, you have a huge birth rate imbalance in terms of the Muslim community. So the demographics speak for themselves. And it isn't that Jews can't live with Muslims and Muslims can't live with Christians, although in many places of the world that's proving true, but because the governments did nothing to integrate these populations. They didn't right. anticipate what the influx of millions of people. It began with the breakdown of the empires when the French gave up their colonies. The Algerians, the Moroccans, and the conflicts in those places brought millions of people to France, millions to the Pakistanis and others earlier to England. And then it spread, and there is an endless supply. One of the Muslim leaders in Europe told me a decade ago, you guys have it all wrong. We don't need nukes. Our nuclear weapon is demography.
So did they, did the governments of Europe, let's say France and other places, were they wrong in the sense that they thought they could integrate these people into their society and it never happened, or they didn't try to integrate them?
They didn't understand them, and unlike other populations, you know, migrant populations that tended to integrate, and in different countries, different circumstances. In Germany, they were Gastarbeiters. They were brought in as workers from Turkey to work in the factories, and they were supposed to rotate out every 3 years, but they didn't leave. And then they had children, and they even have grandchildren, and these people who came as secularists, their grandchildren are radicalized. So the government, who kept them in segregated areas and used them because they need them as a workforce. In France and other places, they didn't understand that, unlike other populations, they don't integrate, they don't intermarry, they are very insular. They created their own ghettos, self-imposed, by government estimate, perhaps 1,600 in France, where Christians and Jews don't go, where the police don't go even. And the government then tried to address this retroactively. In France, for instance, they created a Muslims council, put in millions and millions of dollars, and the radicals took it over. Then they started going after the imams who were preaching messages of hate, but in French, and they deported them or threw them out of their jobs. And now the imams are speaking in Arabic, and they have no clue what they're saying. So the answer to your question is that they did not anticipate, they didn't understand the structure of these societies, how they would feed upon themselves. And then the internet, many other things that enabled people to radicalize, to instruct, to mobilize populations from afar, and to indoctrinate them in the extreme form of Islam. And the imams who came did it as well. 60% of the prisoners in France are Muslims, and they are being indoctrinated and radicalized in the prisons. Again, the governments didn't do anything. Here in the United States, we had a similar problem. So the question is on both levels.
Well, so the question is, can it be changed, or is it irreversible at this point?
The question is, what does the change mean? First, change has to come from within the Muslim community. You have to have people like Sisi who talk about reform in Islam, that they have to isolate the radicals, who are still a minority of the population. I don't want it to sound like, you know, because they have children, they're automatically enemies. But we see that you have high unemployment, lack of integration, poverty, all of these things feed the extremism. But most of all, it's the ideological orientation. You see 1,000 young French guys go to Syria to fight, 450 in Belgium with 11 million people, altogether many thousands from Europe. What are they going to do when they come back? It takes 10 policemen to monitor each one. That's why the two of the guys who carried out the attacks in Paris, who were known, but the police didn't have the resources to constantly follow all of them. Hundreds have come back. And they are increasingly motivated by this radical ideologies from the age of 15 and 16 up. And the governments don't even have the resources. MI5 spends half of its resources in Great Britain just monitoring the guys who are fighting in Syria and those who are coming back. So is it reversible? I don't know. I don't see where the wisdom and the enlightenment on the part of officials, the willingness to name the name and identify the source of the problem, as long as we can't say that it's radical Islam. Muslims are the first victims of these guys. They identify it. President Sisi's speech, read it. He says it so clearly, but Western leaders aren't willing to say who it is. And if you can't name him, if you can't shame him, if you can't try to reclaim the people, then there is no way out of this.
So if the Jewish population, let's assume that there's no real future, Jews unfortunately have to leave Europe, they'll go to different places, Israel, America, Australia, wherever they go. So what happens then in Israel? I mean, don't we need a strong European Jewish voice?
We do. It would be very regrettable, I think, if the voice, and I think that for the foreseeable future, there will be Jews in all the countries of Europe. Many people can't leave. Many people are not financially capable of leaving. Many feel very committed to where they are, and some feel that there isn't a danger, that they haven't experienced it directly. But more and more, that has changed. What 10 years ago French leaders, Jewish leaders, would have said is not what they're saying now. When we used to have these debates about, and I said it then, and many people heard it, me speak about this, that I want people to prepare. I don't ask for panic. I don't want them fleeing their homes, but people should prepare so we can do it in an orderly way. Can Israel absorb hundreds of thousands of people so easily? No. But this is a population that will, you know, contribute a lot. Some will go to Israel. I think many could go. But they also are applying in Australia, Canada, United States. I get calls from people asking how they can assist their families who want to come here. The Israel has to do things to make it more attractive, meaning tax breaks, training, language training, incentives that will be particularly geared to them, just like we did with the baskets we provided to Russian Jews when they came.
Isn't it kind of ironic that maybe one of the best places in Europe is Germany today?
Well, I'm not sure it's one of the best places. We have increased anti-Semitism there. If you look at the attitude studies of the people, they're very disturbing. It is the fastest growing community because Russian Jews and others, including Israelis, go there, and Israelis who have, some who have gone, Jews who have gone to Poland. I think it's misguided. I think that they're not looking at it realistically. There's no country in Europe that will be immune to this, and there's no country where we haven't seen a rise in anti-Semitism. Every country will be affected. Every Jewish community, East and West, will be affected if this cancer is allowed to continue to grow. And the answer has to be government action, concerted action by police, security, by the Jewish communities, of course, to protect themselves, but going after those who are responsible, but also those who aid and abet them. The fact that leaders of Qatar or Turkey who engage in vile incitement against Israel and Jews were allowed to march in that march. And as I said, if all 17 who had been killed were Jews, do you think there would have been a march? Not one French leader that I spoke to, French Jew, said to me the answer was yes. Not one.
So let's talk about the United States. Are we falling into the same trap? And God forbid, are we going to be in the same situation in 5 years or 10 years from now?
There are fundamental differences. The demographic differences are different. In every one of the countries in Europe, Muslims outnumber Jews generally 10 to 1. That is not the case here. There's still more Jews than Muslims. Many of the immigrants, many of the Muslims who are here are not Arabs. They're Pakistani. There are other things. And many of the Arabs are not Muslims. They're Christians who came in earlier years. But the Muslim population is growing very rapidly. We're allowing in 10,000 new immigrants from Syria this year. We're bringing them in from Iraq, let alone the illegal immigration, which the FBI and others have testified before Congress, of the thousands and thousands who have crossed our southern border, Muslims who come into the United States and just as the illegal immigration from other countries. So the demographic balance will change over time. They are also younger. They're having children. And as you know, the overall birth rate for Jews, aside from the Orthodox, is not great.
Right.
But I think that the fundamental commitment, the nature of American society is different. Well, part of the problem is that Europeans have lost their identity. The Catholic churches are empty. I think 7 or 8% go to church regularly. Churches, hundreds of churches in France were sold to become mosques. I think that in America, the fundamentals are different. But it doesn't mean that we're immune to it. It doesn't mean that anti-Semitism won't increase here. We do see it on some campuses, and whether it takes the guise of the BDS and anti-Israelism and, you know, saying, oh, it's not Jews, it's those Jews, it's the Israelis, when we know they're going after the collective Jew because it's more acceptable, not because it's not driven by an animosity towards Jews and towards Jewish people. So we have to be very alert. We have to work with our government, as we are doing, and we have set up SCAN, Secure Community Network, which I hope every OU synagogue is working with.
Absolutely.
To improve security. But we have many yeshivot, we have schools, we have thousands and thousands of institutions that need to be protected and better protected. And I know, though, you did a good job with the government grants for security. But it has to be sustained. It's not a one-shot deal. So, you know, God forbid there's an attack, everybody reacts. But then 2 weeks later, as it fades, we all go back to business as usual.
What about in the prisons? I know, reading articles about it, and even in the American prisons, the radicalization of Islam, people coming in as prisoners, walking out as, you know, Islamic fundamentalists. Is that being addressed at all? Is that a big issue?
It is a serious issue. There was a thing called the Islamic Prisoners Army. I met with President Clinton about it because Muslims were telling us, Muslim imams who were fired because they were too moderate and told me that you cannot get a piece of moderate literature into a federal prison. And the situation continues to obtain where you have a radicalization of Muslim prisoners in the prisons. Chuck Colson and others who worked in prisons were writing about it, spoke about it. From my understanding, it still continues. I think there were efforts to try and contain it, but we know it's still one of the places for recruitment.
Right, right. And I guess just, we can go on and on, but I only have another minute or two. I appreciate your time. I know how busy you are. The concept of when you read, like you see the movie that just came out, Selma, or you read about somehow, why is it that you go to South Africa, we've been there together, why is it that the plight of the Palestinians, as Israel is being seen as an apartheid state, which then contributes, of course, to anti-Semitism, because anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. That's exactly what it is. Why has this happened, and is there anything we can do about it?
Absolutely, we can do something about it, and that is to get out the positive message. We are working in African countries to bring the message of Israel, to explain the truth, to bring leaders from those countries to Israel, as well as Black Americans and Asian Americans and other leaders, influentials, because the best thing to sell Israel is Israel, that once people see the truth, every one of the people we took say it's 180 degrees different what they anticipated. Half the American people believe that Israel's an apartheid state. They don't have a clue what it means, but they believe it. And we've shown that by education, information, and by concerted action. And we have to also name those who engage in anti-Israel incitement. We can't see them being feted at White Houses or official functions. We have to isolate them as we would any other radical element. And we have to also understand that a lot of this gets government funding from Arab governments, even the EU funds organizations that are promulgating anti-Israel messages. And we believe that there are sources here, organizations here in the United States who get foreign funds, as well as funds from radical elements in the United States. Israel becomes the symbol of the West. And you can't attack the United States. I mean, criticize it. But Israel is seen as more vulnerable, and that if you do BDS, if you do the other campaigns, that you strike a blow against the West, and its identification, the identification of Israel and the United States, is very strong. So you have this dangerous cocktail of anti-Americanism, anti-globalization, et cetera. Israel, as a symbol of it, seen as the more vulnerable one, becomes a major target. When, in fact, if you look at the record, it's obviously very different. Which country integrated the populations, took in blacks from Africa, took in others. And those are messages we have to get out. And we have Rethink Israel. We're doing things online. We're trying to create capacity to be able to tell the truth about what is going on, but we face formidable enemies and huge resources that can be put up against us. So every community from the most grassroots level has to reach out to people. We have to reach out to elected officials. We have to reach out to religious leaders. We have to find influentials who can speak and get the truth out. That's our strongest weapon. And to defending Israel, to fight the extremists, truth is the strongest weapon.
You're right. Truth is MS is MS. That's what it's all about. Listen, Malcolm, thank you so much. First of all, for everything you do, for everything you do for the Jewish community. It's been my honor to have you on the program. We've been talking to Malcolm Homeland, the Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Hatzlacha to you. Good health. Continue to do all the work that you do. Okay?
Thank you so much. And thank you for all you do.
Thank you. Bye-bye.